At this time, I would like to turn the time over to Dr. William Sook, Director of the Superfund Research Program. Bill?
Justin, thank you very much, and welcome on behalf of NIEHS and its Superfund Research Program. You're now on slide number 2, and I want to first of all tell you the purpose of this webinar series, which is to get your input on our strategic planning process. This is a fourth such process, and each has been differently done than the one in the past. But each one of these processes, especially this particular one, is important to ensure the program, how the program evolves and continues to mature. There will be formal presentations followed by some discussion, and I want you to please participate in the entire program, especially when we get to Larry Reed's portion for the response to the different questions. We now have the agenda, as you see it in front of you, is to look at the program mandates and give you a brief historical perspective, give you a brief idea about the strategic planning process, and then we're going to move on to the response to the questions, which will be longer and will require your input and participation. Next slide, please. The Superfund Research Program was authorized under SARA, Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, in 1986. It was congressionally mandated to be administered by NIEHS to support interdisciplinary research between different disciplines, biomedical research such as molecular biology and epidemiology as two broad spectrums, engineering, the geosciences, as well as ecologically based studies. We are also engaged in training of young investigators in this particular interdisciplinary approach to research. We are engaged in community outreach and partnering with a variety of audiences and in the transfer of technology and the translation of these research findings for future activities. These are our four mandates, and I'm just going to briefly mention what they are so that you know them, because I know you can't see the little dog-eared piece of paper there. We're authorized to develop methods and technologies to detect hazardous substances in the environment. We are authorized to support advanced techniques for the detection, assessment, and evaluation of the human health effects to hazardous substances. We are authorized to develop methods to assess the risk to human health presented by hazardous substances. And we are authorized to support basic biological, chemical, and physical methods to reduce the amount and toxicity of hazardous substances. We interpret or have interpreted these four mandates over the years in a much more cross-disciplinary approach to address some very complex issues. The realization early on in this program was that each discipline would only be able to address the question in their particular focus. But by recreating an interface between the disciplines, we should be able to address the much more complex health and environmental issues that we are faced with. Next slide, please. Number 5, we're up to number 5. So, the overarching goals of the program are to elucidate the relationship between exposure and disease. to develop efficient and cost-effective cleanup strategies as well as detection technologies. We are also looking at goals to conduct science that contributes to human health risk assessment and decision making for remediation, and again to reduce the risk of exposure and to improve public health. Essentially, the program is a prevention program that is designed to address hard questions and to provide people with the ability to make informed decisions based upon a sound foundation of science. Now, I would like to, after that brief introduction, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Heather Henley. We'll now tell you how the SRP has approached its mandates in the past to inform your discussion about directions for the future of the program. Heather?
Thank you, Dr. Silk. We're on slide 6 now. What I'd like to do is just give you an overview of what the program is at the moment, and that, of course, starts with the scope of our program. You can see in the United States map there, as well as the INSET global map, that we have a number of grantees out there, and this is through a $50 million a year budget program. We fund over 500 investigators, over 100 graduate students, and they're represented in multiple programs throughout the U.S. and with affiliated partners in international locations as well. The program, as Dr. Stook mentioned, focuses on basic research. And one overarching expectation that we have for our grantees is to achieve interdisciplinary research. So I'm going to give you a little more detail on slide 7 about the different types of grants that we fund, and in doing so, we'll also give you an idea how we accomplish the applied side of basic research, as well as how we achieve interdisciplinary research. So on slide 7. If you'd please turn there. The staple of our program really are the multi-project program grants. These fund an average of maybe 10 projects within a program, and it allows for integration across many different disciplines within these projects. We ask that the grantees have a combination of biomedical research, which might be toxicology, epidemiology, or other molecular biology research that researches human health effects. And we ask that there also is a component of non-biomedical research, which might be the geosciences, engineering, ecology, or a variety of other disciplines. So that's how we try to achieve interdisciplinary integration within these multi-project program grants. We do incorporate both basic and application-oriented research, and as in the case with these project grants, which people apply in response to a request for applications, we do encourage grantees to make connections with federal partners or with site managers, or to actually conduct research on sites or in real-world conditions. So that's one way that we can accomplish a basic program, but have it be application-oriented. The next group of, and I wanted to mention, we do have about 14 of the multi-project program grants throughout the U.S. The next type of funding mechanism that we've been supporting is the individual researcher, which is an R01 mechanism. And this is designed to address specific issues to complement the multi-project research programs and also to tackle issues of emerging concern for Superfund. We currently fund about 19 of those projects, and those grants were, again, submitted in response to a specific request for applications, and we had two rounds of that, one that covered in-situ approaches to the remediation of contaminated sediments, and another that asked for applications with regard to using nanotechnology-based approaches to understand the mechanisms of bioremediation. So our two, the 19 programs the 19 projects that are represented in that funding mechanism tend to be about contaminated sediments and bioremediation. Lastly, we do offer small business innovative research and technology transfer grant funding opportunities. And these are designed to foster the commercialization of technologies. These products and devices are relevant to clean up and to moderate, monitoring contaminants and waste streams. I'll just back up again. The multi-project program grants, these are about five-year awards up to that amount, and we've been funding these for about 20 years. The individual research project grants, those are three-year awards, and we've been funding them for the last 4 to 5 years. And the small business innovative research grants, we've been funding those in the last approximately 10 years. So next slide. Waiting for mine to come up. Sorry for that delay. So I wanted to give you an idea of that, you know, we are a funding organization. We fund basic research, university research, also small business research, as you've heard. But we do want to emphasize that we're beyond just a research organization. Very important to us is training. That's even in our mandate. In addition to that, we feel that community outreach and research translation are important ways to make sure that the products from the program are being utilized and making an impact for the people who really need the data and tools that come out of the program. These are accomplished through two different approaches. I mean, programmatically, those of us who are here at NIEHS and work for SRP, we certainly strive to make connections between trainees and advancing their careers, reaching out to communities, and in particular research translation, forming partnerships with other federal or state, as it were, organizations that have interest in the program. But we also accomplish this through formal mechanisms. In particular, our multi-project program grants have the option of including a training core as well as a community outreach core. So those And by doing so, we allow the researchers themselves to establish a strong bond both with the students and with the community based on the type of research program that they are running. We also have, as a requirement, a research translation core within each of these large multi-project program grants. And the purpose of that core is to make a connection, again, between the research that's being conducted in the program and finding users out there in the community, both broad audiences, you know, such as neighborhoods and, help me out here, guys.
community-based organizations.
Community-based organizations. We also encourage research translation to reach out to federal and state government, as well as local tribal governments. Again, finding partners for the research that's coming out of the program. And then again, technology transfer is another part of that, that when possible, you know, sometimes these programs that we've been funding for a while, their research becomes ready for transfer into a commercial product, and so we encourage that to happen as well. Now moving on to slide 9. I'm going to pass it off to Dr. Claudia Thompson.
Okay. Thank you, Heather. First, I'd like to echo what Dr. Bill Sook said in welcoming you to today's webinar focused on the strategic plan for the Superfund Research Program. So you may be asking, why a strategic plan? Well, the program, as you heard, has been in existence for over 20 years. Over the years, we've had a number of activities where we've brought in different groups of external advisory panels and experts to guide the science for the program, and we've used this information a number of different ways as we've developed science that goes out for requests for applications, etc. The most recent advisory panel that we convened was last year in early 2009. Again, and the goal of that was for them to provide guidance to us as we develop a framework for developing a strategic plan. So although we've had input and we've developed activities based on information we've received over the years, we thought really at this juncture, with the program being over 20 years old, it was really important to develop a more formal strategic document that would just enhance the transparency of this program, to be able to communicate to many different groups what our program is about, where we see the Superfund research program being in the next 5 to 10 years, and to get input from as many different groups as we can. So, as I've mentioned, this framework, the strategic plan is really going to provide a framework to guide us, to help prioritize the scope of science that we conduct within the program, to assist in establishing an approach for attaining both scientific balance and growth, as well as what Dr. Henry talked about, enhancing our translation, our community outreach and training, so that the science that we conduct is usable by many different groups. And lastly, the strategic plan, the framework that we'll be developing, will provide guidelines to us at NIEHS in managing the program and decision-making, and again, to make those aspects transparent to the community so you'll know where we're at and where we're coming from and where we're going. So, again, ultimately, the strategic plan will enable us to better promote the use of the Superfund research program's resources to protect human health. Next slide, please. Very briefly, as you can see from slide number 10, you can see that we're reaching out to many different groups. We've identified several on this slide, including the lay public, environmental health researchers, government agencies, both our sister Superfund agencies, EPA and ATSDR, as well as other federal, state, and local groups, tribes, NGOs, etc. In addition to this list that we have here, the last bullet says, who else? And as you'll see as we move forward, we have a question that asks from you, to identify who else we should be thinking about and bringing into the Superfund research program family. So if we move on to slide 11, I'd just like to briefly touch on what our process is for the strategic plan. We've developed, we're using many different formats and approaches, utilizing the most current technologies to get input from as vast a group of individuals as we can. So we have these web-based seminars. This is the first of two that we'll be holding between now and the end of January. In addition, we're holding a series of public meetings. We had one in November at the Superfund Research Program's annual meeting. We have others scheduled for January in the Washington, D.C. area, as well as the West Coast. And we've also been at some other scientific meetings where we've had gotten input from, scientists that were attending those. In addition to the public meetings and the seminars, we will be having an online questionnaire that will be announced in a request for information that's in the NIH guide, and we also plan to put that in the Federal Register. So that, again, will explain the goals and purpose of this strategic plan, and it will list the 7 questions that we will be discussing in just a few minutes with you. I understand that some people love to talk in public, and today's session, we're really encouraging that dialogue. We want to hear from you, but we think it's important that you hear what others have to think, and that will fuel, maybe future thoughts or that you may have. So if you don't feel totally comfortable, telling us in public all that you feel, there will be opportunities within the day or so for you to go online and fill out the questionnaire. And if you're interested, we will be sending an email to you when that questionnaire is live. It will be open to the public through January 29th. So we really hope that you will go online and also answer the questions, and that you will share these questions with your colleagues to get as broad an input as we can. So on slide 12, you may ask, okay, so we've developed these series of questions. What are we planning on doing, and how are we going to handle all this input? So, you know, as I've already mentioned, we're looking forward to this question today, and we will have the online questionnaire. But beyond that, from this meeting, the other face-to-face meetings, et cetera, at the end of January, our intent and plan is that we will compile all the input that we have that will help us identify themes, and that we'll use this information to develop our strategic plan. We plan on posting a summary of the discussions on our website so that you can check back intermittently and see feedback that we have gotten. After the end of January, the group here at NIEHS will again take all of this input and draft a draft strategic plan. That plan, our intent is to put that out for public comment. We will announce it both on our website and in the Federal Register, and that will probably be available for comment for about a month. Once we receive all these public comments, we'll finalize the draft and present that to our the NIEHS's advisory council in May. So with that, I'd like to go to slide 13 and introduce Mr. Larry Reed, who is going to be our facilitator for the next hour or so as we move forward into the questions.
Thank you, Claudia. As most people on the call might know, NIEHS Superfund Research Program has been working for years in partnership with EPA for these types of webinar seminars that have been given over the past few years. This is a little bit of a different approach, though, because usually a webinar is some SRP scientists giving some current science and then people sending in questions. What we really hope to have here is us raising the questions and you sending in comments and responses as an opportunity, as Claudia was just saying, for you to be able to influence the future of the Superfund research program. We have a reasonable size group on the phone with us today and simulcast. We're hoping that will provide a more interactive kind of environment here. We're encouraging people on the phone to raise comments, thoughts, experiences that you've had in these various areas that we're going to be raising. And also the people on simulcast, we definitely encourage you to be sending in comments, brief notes, your interest, and suggestions you have, because we'll periodically, through this discussion, go back to those comments that are coming in and make sure that your input is brought up in these sessions, and we'll encourage, again, a more interactive kind of process that we broached here today. I know on the as part of the simulcast on the phone, we've got three, on the phone alone, we have three different state health departments, three different EPA regional offices, a variety of research firms and research universities. On simulcast, we've got another three state health departments, four state environmental agencies, and another three or four regional offices. So again, it's a good mix, so we encourage you to feel comfortable in raising, again, the experiences you had, your comments, your reactions, your suggestions, creative ideas, all of the above. What we're going to do is, for the this slide and the next slide, is basically just walk through the seven different question areas that we've got, and then come back, and our intent is to walk through each question and, again, provide time for those of you on the phone and those of you participating by simulcast to be able to raise the your thoughts, your input on where this program should be going in the future. So let's first just sort of walk through the seven different question areas. On slide 13, the first area of interest is scope of the science. There we're looking at what are the scientific themes and issues that are most important to be addressed by the Superfund research program, and importantly, why. We'd certainly like your insights into why you would suggest those areas. And again, just as important as the themes and issues is your suggestions for what prioritization criteria the SRP could use to guide the inclusion of these very important issues and themes into future program activities. The second question area is our approach to science, and there we're asking for what are the various key themes and scientific disciplines needed for the SRP to make the greatest advances in dealing with these important scientific themes and issues that would be most important to you in your program directions. The third area is interdisciplinary science. And again, for those of you who are familiar and have worked with the program, that the interdisciplinary nature of the program is critical. And the current framework that was described earlier, we'd like to know, is this most current approach that we use in the program, is that the most effective approach? Again, why or why not you like the present approach or suggestions you would make to improving it? Related to that, in dealing with interdisciplinary science and research, it would appreciate hearing from you as far as what are the specific barriers to interdisciplinary research and what that SRP should know about. And then how would you suggest that ASRP might be able to overcome these issues? Moving on to slide 14, please. The next question area is training. As we mentioned before, given the interdisciplinary nature of the Superfund research program, we'd like to hear from you as far as what approaches to training you would consider to be the most appropriate for SRP. We'll get into that in greater detail. And it really relates to the future of the program and how it can contribute to the next generation of scientists. The fifth area is dealing with stakeholders. Who are SRP stakeholders? And again, just as importantly, how can SRP most effectively interact with them? The sixth area is research translation. And there we're looking at what are the best ways for the SRP to achieve its goal of research translation, as defined earlier, and that is, what we mean by that is making research more accessible by end users, you on the phone, and your colleagues. And lastly, the seventh area is what are the appropriate goals for SRP in dealing with community outreach? We'll come back to that. So could we move to slide 15, which will start with the specific question areas. And as we are saying here, the first critical area deals with the scope of the science. The two related questions that we're looking at is what are the scientific themes and issues that are most critical to address in the Superfund research program, and from your perspective, why? From your perspective and your experiences. And then related to that, we'd be interested in what prioritization criteria SRP should use to really be guiding the inclusion of those important themes and issues to you in the future program activities. So at this point, we'd sort of like to open it up. This is your webinar. As we mentioned, this is our goal is to get your ideas and your input to where the program should be going. This is the first of the critical issue areas, and this would like to encourage folks to step up now and give us your thoughts and your suggestions. And when you speak up, we'd appreciate if you just give your affiliation. And maybe what I'd like to start with is knowing that, again, we have a wide variety of people that have signed up on the call, and start with the call. And I think it's maybe appropriate that we start with an EPA regional person. And I believe we have Shelley Brody from Kansas City EPA Regional Office on the line, maybe with a group of colleagues. Shelley, are you there? With the phone on mute, perhaps? Okay. Shelley might be getting folks organized out there. Let me move on to another colleague in EPA Regional Office, Mark Madaloni. Dr. Madaloni in the New York Regional Office, are you on the phone? And again, this is from your perspectives for those of you who are either doing research in the area or are practitioners that are dealing with the hazardous substances, Superfund, RCRA programs out there dealing with the wide variety of scientific uncertainties out there. What are the uncertainties that you're wrestling with out there that are critical to your programs? These are the kinds of inputs, again, that we would find useful on the call.
Larry, this is Justin Crane again. Just to interject, I just wanted to make sure all the phone participants realize they need to take their phones off mute by pressing star 6.
Thank you, Justin.
Hi, Larry. This is Mark.
Mark Pantalone.
Yeah, I thought I was off mute, but I just realized I had to press star 6. So sorry, I didn't intend just to leave you hanging out there for so long.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, we've been dealing with two types of Superfund sites in our region recently, and they sort of connected in. Well, and I'll go into it in a moment, and I'm just trying to figure out how to wedge this into the scope of the science, because this is clearly more practitioner or applications oriented rather than basic research. But we have a site on Staten Island, which is a very localized old lead production plant, and they've created a lot of hazards right within the site. But then we see that, you know, we're having a hard time, you know, tracking the lead contamination off-site, you know, related to this particular activity, which, you know, because Superfund is a program that you need to be able to track it to a specific source, as you well know, Larry, having, you know, run the program for a while, it's, you know, we're struggling to try to address what is clearly elevated blood lead concentrations in this whole northern tier of Staten Island, this whole Port Richmond community, but we can't really attribute the lead contamination, or at least in any significant amount, to this one particular site. So it's sort of like, I don't know if I call it cumulative risk, but of exposure issues, where we have many sources, but we can't pin it down to one particular source that we could, you know, then trigger, you know, Superfund monies to address. So it's a much more programmatic issue, I guess. But that's one. But that's a more cumulative exposure. Then we have another site up in Ringwood where it's mostly a Native American population. They've been exposed to a lot of things. But they also, and let's try to put this gently, you know, have some lifestyle issues that are creating a lot of other health-related effects, you know, poor diets, poor access to health care, and so on and so forth. And so, again, you have a lot of cumulative risk issues that go beyond just the just traditionally what Superfund can address just by tracking chemical contaminants from a particular source. So this is something we've been struggling with, and I don't know that this program is going to be able to help, but I figured if I had an opportunity to air our troubles here, you know, I figured I'd take it.
No, that's it. Yeah, please.
Did you want others to weigh in support of the comments or what? Refuting?
Yes.
Did you want?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Ron Landy from ORD EPA, and as I think you know, cum risk is an area that. It's definitely an emerging research area in ORD, and we've engaged a lot with our region, so that's one that, you know, we are very supportive of. We recently held a cumulative risk workshop in EPA 5, but that's definitely one that I think there's a lot of interest across EPA and, you know, our state partners.
Good. And particularly on the cumulative risk, it's interesting that the point you raise, both you raised, but Mark in particular, you were making the point that there's a certain kind of fingerprinting of the lead, that there has to be a Superfund hook there somewhere, I think is what you were saying, Mark. There could be multiple sources, but there has to be, you know, some connection to the Superfund or RCRA hazardous waste site. Is that one of the points you were raising?
Absolutely, Larry, and you know, we actually did a very sophisticated isotopic analysis, and we really, based on some, well, we think pretty good science, we just haven't been able to track the lead, which is clearly out there in the community, back to this site. You know, we're saying there is a lead problem here, but we can't, not in any traditional sense, utilize the removal program, to address it. And that just gets into one other question, because you asked earlier, I don't know if it was Heather or Claudia, about who else we could partner with, and there was that last one, other, and we've been talking ourselves with HUD, to try to get other monies to address this whole area-wide lead, environmental lead issue, which, goes well beyond this one site, and one of the areas, one of the groups that we might look to is foundations, philanthropic, I know for one, a Healthy Homes Initiative, the Annie E. Casey Foundation is, takes the lead in, dealing with these. And again, it's a cumulative risk because they're looking at healthy homes. They realize that, a healthy home, transcends any one particular contaminant, whether it be lead or asbestos or mold or, anything else. So, we are trying to partner with some other organizations, and it sounds funny having the federal government have to go begging, if you will, the philanthropies, but that's what we might wind up doing because we can't use Superfund monies to address an environmental lead issue that extends well beyond a particular site.
Good point. And maybe leveraging back to Ron Landy's point, Ron, when you raised earlier, when you're looking at cumulative risk, are other aspects of that coming up when you're dealing with the various Superfund technical liaisons across the regions in addition to issues, in addition to fingerprinting lead, as Mark was raising? Do you have other aspects of cumulative risk that you would suggest that SRP should be looking into?
There's a whole load of them, and I won't take the time on the call, but there's a proceedings from the workshop that we held on some of the priority research needs, and we'd be happy to share that with you or have some of the people that were involved in organizing and putting together the proceedings, put together a list of priorities that came out of that. And that workshop also brought in tribal and EJ and disproportionate exposure and people's lifestyles and all kind of other factors that could contribute to unique exposure scenarios that are not covered in the present attempts to determine how severe it is, sources, impacts, all the things. So, I mean, that was a pretty significant effort that was held, and, we'd be happy to share that with you in whatever way you think you could use it.
That'd be great. Heather was just suggesting that we could certainly post that as a follow-up to on ClueIn, so we could share that with others here too, the other participants on the webinar. So thank you, Ron.
Sure.
I guess also just asking the others, we have a few states on the phone, the health departments, either your general areas of scientific uncertainty that you think we should be raising here, important issues to you that you think we should bring up. And don't forget that you have to press *6 to get yourself off mute, and if you're talking to yourself in the room and wondering why we're not listening, that might be the problem.
Larry, can you hear us now?
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, we've been off mute, but it seemed like there were some technical difficulties. This is Shelley Brody, RPM in Region 7, and also here is Rob Weber from ORD and Matt Jefferson, who's now in Region 7. Just wanted to let you know that we've been hearing the comments so far, and initial thoughts as far as just general science, two things immediately came to mind, at least to me, and then I'll let Rob and Matt, pitch in if they have something. One that particularly concerns me, and you all have done a lot of work in this area, but I think we need to do more, is on all the endocrine disruptors. I remember hearing about that, I think, 20 years ago, and just now, it took that long of a lag time to get it into common public concern and hearing about it on TV to the extent where even, Canada has now regulated phthalates and taking them out and not allowing any plastic for children baby bottles, and they're looking at others. And I guess my general concern would be, can we boost the science to the degree that we can move quicker from seeing those concerns to working with industry to remove some of these toxic chemicals from products that are now so pervasive for all of us. And a general, just getting to the next general topic in the science, as a practitioner in the field, both, you know, Rob, Matt, and I have all worked on a variety of different projects, and regardless of the contaminant or the risk to the population, is there a way that, and this could be discussed on another call, that we could try to collaborate quicker, more efficiently with the risk assessors throughout EPA? Because as we make those decisions, and I can consider the science and the research briefs you've all contributed to my knowledge, I'm still pretty much got my hands tied to do what the current EPA risk guidance states. And if we could, you know, bring those two together quicker, you know, on the same page, I think we'd get a lot more out of, you know, both of those entities. And I know that may have to do with both jurisdictional issues on EPA side, but I could see that as real helpful, particularly for all the new RPMs that may not have the experience that Rob or Matt or others do, and we still have some degree of authority and a subjectivity in our decisions that we'd like to be able to rely more on just the risk guidance. So those are two general, very broad areas that I had some concerns with.
Great. Thank you, Shelley. Any other reactions to the needs that have been raised to this point from the other participants? Okay.
This is.
I guess it should. Go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt anyone else. This is Ron. Was there someone else trying to chime in?
I don't think so, Ron. Go ahead.
All the lines, really quick. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute all the lines in case there are others out there that are having problems with the mute button. So since I'm going to unmute all the lines, after you are done talking, please go ahead and press *6 to remute your line. I just wanted to make sure to give everyone the opportunity.
All participants have been unmuted.
All right, go ahead. Thank you.
Sure. I was just going to mention a few others, not necessarily in priority, but just kind of the shopping list of interest. Obviously, cost-effective technologies with, you know, budget situations and costs is a real big one. And one area that, you know, we're very interested in the Office of Research and Development in some of our regions is the potential for nanotechnologies. We've had a few that have been pretty successful, so it seems like an area that might be worth exploring, and we don't have the in-house capability. So if some of the people in the academic community with expertise, that would be really valuable. And kind of along the same lines, you know, we brought this up at the New York City meeting, green remediation along with cost-effective technologies is a strong area of interest. Another one is mixtures. You know, we're constantly grappling with the issue of multiple exposures to chemicals which may have similar effects endpoints. And then the last one, I'll stop there because that gets us up to about 5. We don't want to overwhelm you, but those are 5 big ones that I would like to put on the list.
Good. Thank you, Ron. And we did get some email notes coming in, and Claudia, would you like to raise one?
Sure.
Bill Hagel.
So we received an email from Bill Hagel at in Philadelphia, and his comment was that he encouraged that the themes and issues for research should really complement the research needs of the customers such that implement the Superfund program, EPA, the state, DOD, et cetera. And that a pointed effort from input from regionally implemented programs is needed to identify these needs. He thought that often there could be a disconnect between the risk management needs of practitioners in the field, which, you know, is normally a sort of very short-term turnaround,
and the eventual product that comes from research, which tends to have a longer time frame from 3 to 5 years. So that being said, there are a number of long-term issues that he felt needed additional research, and these include bioavailability of contaminants, particularly for risk assessment purposes, green remediation, vapor intrusion, emerging contaminants, and I'd love to hear some discussion from those out there what you consider emerging contaminants. That's something we struggle with. Would really like to get input from you on that topic. Re-emerging contaminants such as TCE, chromium, and as we've just heard, nanotechnology, both as contaminants as well as materials management. So that was one of our email comments.
Thank you, Claudia. The second part of this question, too, so anyone, again, as Claudia was saying, the emerging contaminants issue, if you have something, a key point to raise there, please bring it in either by email or verbally on the phone before we move off to our next question. Just the last area there, too, is priority setting. That's always tough to do. We never have enough resources in the public sector, so you have to set priorities. And this is an earnest question, I think, from the Superfund research program coming out to you all, is, you know, what criteria do you use yourselves, either in your research or in your field work, and broad national criteria that you think would be appropriate to be used in setting priorities for the, again, multiple competing needs? Would appreciate, again, your reactions now. Or, again, as was said earlier, the questionnaire will be coming out, and we certainly want people's additional thoughts included in there in the future if other thoughts come to you later and would like to include those.
Hi, this is David Fair. I'm a toxicologist with the Oregon Public Health Division.
David, please, join us.
Hey, so I have a I'm always looking for the right venue to make this suggestion, but to me it sort of fits in this general scope of the Superfund research program, and that is that for toxicity values that are used, I think Iris does a great job pulling together all the literature that exists on. As far as putting together dose response information, but one thing that I remember, especially from working in academia before I came here, was that researchers often talked about how it would be very difficult to get funding to do basic research that was just geared towards deriving a benchmark dose or a point of departure for the intent of developing a reference dose. And I'm not sure, part of that is institutional, just because it's difficult to get published anywhere if all you do is do dose response studies to develop a reference dose. But any way to get more funding or make it more enticing for people in academia or anywhere, I guess, to do studies that are designed to get designed from the outset to get to test low doses and find a realistic reference dose would be pretty cool.
Larry, this is Mark. Can I just expand on that?
Please.
As the previous speaker was saying, you know, Iris does a good job with chronic toxicity values, and we have increasingly greater emphasis on acute, through the EAGLES, which is a joint effort with too many federal agencies. But in this day, especially being here in New York and being very CBR, chemical, biological, radiological incident type sensitive, and having endured the World Trade Center incident. We are, you know, constantly looking for toxicity criteria that scans the entire gamut from the acute to the chronic. And, you know, there's a large, you know, vast swath of uncharted territory between, you know, the iris reference doses and cancer slope factors and these, you know, eagles, which generally run from 1 to 8 hours. And so, you know, talking about just developing basic, you know, dose response, we need more of that in that, you know, that area between the acute and the chronic, or it's, you know, subacute or subchronic or short term, whatever you want to describe it as. But, you know, as you go from the initial incident, you know, where it's, you know, do we evacuate or not? So, you know, before you get to those questions, can someone live here for the next 30 or 40 years? There's that, you know, that whole subchronic, exposure, consideration, and we just don't have the toxicity criteria to match the exposure scenarios, so we certainly need more work in that area.
Okay.
I know Homeland Security Research Center is aware of that and they're working on it, but I think we probably should try to bring as much resources to that as possible.
That's a good point. There is, you know, as you all know, a lot of interaction between SRP and Ron Landy and the other ORD folks there integrating and collaborating on the research. So those are good topics. We probably should move on to the second question area. Again, if more thoughts come to you later, we're going to work through each of the questions so we make sure we get input from folks who have suggestions, ideas in each one of these areas. But the second question area on slide 16 is, what are the key teams and scientific disciplines needed for the SRP to make the greatest advances in the important scientific themes and issues for the program? And again, as was mentioned in the introduction, interdisciplinary research has been a key aspect of the program from the beginning. And we'd like to open it up at this point, again, depending on what environmental public health niche you all occupy on the phone. I guess, what are your experiences as far as, you know, whom do you go to for your scientific needs? Which disciplines? What are your greatest scientific uncertainties? And, you know, how should those be addressed? That's the kind of thing we'd like to open it up to. You know, which discipline, scientific disciplines, do you rely on the most and wish you had greater access to? That might be a good segue into the interdisciplinary key teams that SRP should be using. Let me open it up at that point. And Shelley might ask you and your colleagues there, when, you know, you're out working at hazardous waste sites, which disciplines do you call upon and which are the areas of uncertainty that you're wrestling with that might be, you know, a future direction of the SRP?
Sounds great. It's typical for, now, consider I'm in the Midwest and we have more agricultural than industrial problems in this 4-state region of Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. My typical expertise is going to always include a geologist, just so I'll know the fate and transport realm, and I'm not a geologist. And then I say the next two critical are, you know, really relevant to you all, are the toxicologist and probably someone like some APSCR, someone who would have a public health perspective. The reason for that's obvious. I'm not one, and then depending on what I find, what particular contaminant, whether it's in the soil, you know, the water, whatever manner, then looking at that to try to decide, is it available to the affected population? You know, in a lot of the Midwest, a lot of the populations are in rural areas. They're not necessarily on public drinking water. So, number one, they're not getting any protection via any monitoring, and they're on private wells, and a lot of them are pretty vulnerable to the large-scale agricultural practices that we have. But typically, I always have the geologist, the toxicologist, and the public health person. On more advanced part of the process, when we're at the remedial design, I'm probably going to use more of the engineering, you know, skills then. I don't know, Rob and Matt, do you have something similar? Do you see anything different?
you know, we have...
I think I would agree with that. I think that sort of we have a good basis on sort of the science and engineering, but it's the specialty expertise that, you know, would be truly valuable in the, at least contributing to what we would need from the program sake.
An example, a real-life example to bring this home. There's a little town, a couple thousand people, no public water. They don't want public water. They don't want to pay a water bill. And almost all of their wells are contaminated. But they're contaminated from the legal application of pesticides and fertilizers. And what was helpful to me, just by hook and by crook, was to talk to a gentleman named Jim Elhoff through, I think, either USDA or one of the universities, and I apologize, I can't recall off the top of my head, but he knows, they know the typical exposure based on how much of a pesticide, what application rate, what you might see in the soil after a heavy rain, to help me decide, was this an intermittent one-time release, or is this a long-term bill that's still, you know, remaining in the soil. And there's a hypothesis out there now that why we're seeing undulating exposure levels over a 15-year period, ironically, may have to do with the flood that at one time immersed the area. So some of this is beyond any one particular expertise, but you're trying to wrestle with, well, do I have a new source? Is it an old source that's just gotten remobilized? And it's just by luck knowing individuals with, at this time, a state, Iowa Department of Natural Resources, who knew they had this brilliant contact that I could talk with. And then ultimately talking with Monsanto, who could tell me the specific difference in their view between acetochlor or aliquor. But, you know, for an RPM who's got a basic degree in environmental science or biology, we still have a lot of legwork to do to finally get to that question where you're telling a citizen, well, I still think this exposure is acceptable or not acceptable. I don't know if that helps, but, and that's specifically for an agricultural area. Where I'm from in Florida, we had similar things because the aquifer was so close to the surface, and there's a huge citrus industry there. So I imagine it's different in different regions.
Okay. Now, that's helpful, Shelley. I appreciate that real-world kind of, you know, cross-cutting issues. You go everywhere from heavy-duty toxics to, you know, runoff pesticides in the groundwater. Maybe we'd like to, you know, how about the state health agencies? David, you spoke up earlier, but there are a couple other health agencies, state health agencies on the line. What kind of, again, scientific disciplines do you use to bring to account when you're working on toxic issues out there and ones that you might suggest that we, in the SRP program, integrate into the future of the research? Okay. How about, we have some, I believe we've got some corporate folks on there. Might ask, for those of you in industry who are working, obviously, I assume would also be looking at interdisciplinary applications. Do you have any reactions there that you would suggest on the application that you've seen that would apply to future Superfund research program work? Yeah. I'm trying to think. I guess we could move on to the next question area. If we could move on to slide 17. Again, continuing the theme of interdisciplinary research. Given the interdisciplinary nature of the Superfund research program, basically, as the current framework is described earlier by Bill, Claudia, and Heather, the most effective approach, you think, in focusing on research programs in the future, specifically, why or why not? A point I think I'd raise here is, years ago, I remember hearing the former director of the NIEHS speak, and he, to paraphrase, his saying was something to the effect that the greatest scientific advances in the future will come at the frontiers of the various scientific disciplines. That's where the uncertainties will be intersecting, and you'll get the synergy of the various scientific disciplines making broad advances. So Again, this is, I think, what we'd like to open up to you all. Is your reaction on the interdisciplinary research? Do you see the benefit of it? Again, I think from people working at hazardous waste sites in the field, as Shelley had mentioned earlier, it's a team effort, bringing on chemists, geologists, toxicologists, engineers, and other disciplines. So I guess just be opening it up there to your reaction on the interdisciplinary future of the SRP. Yeah, and also, I guess, again, to the various academics, the researchers on the line there, would certainly want to bring you into the discussions. I know, again, there are a lot on the simulcast and the calls here, so it would open up that way. And then also related to that are the specific barriers. Shall I get someone speak? One of the specific barriers to the interdisciplinary research that SRP should be able to address, and particularly how can we overcome those issues?
Larry?
Again, yes.
This is Meredith Golden from
Columbia.
Hi. I just want to point out that I think the interdisciplinary approach of SRP is very innovative and has actually worked very well at Columbia. But as a social scientist to start with, I would personally like to see some of that. I found that we've had to bring in social scientists at times to deal with some of our research translation issues and exposure assessment issues. So I just wanted to throw that out.
Good point. Thank you, Meredith. Again, that's a broad range, as Meredith was bringing up when we're talking interdisciplinary. I think many folks think of the traditional biological hard sciences, but even there, it's a question of the various subfields among those science disciplines, as well as broadening it out to the social sciences to particularly focus on public interaction in dealing with the research.
Well, Larry, this is Mark again. This, you know, when I talk about interdisciplinary, there's the laundry list of, you know, all the different types of expertise you need. And certainly, you know, as a toxicologist, first and foremost, understanding dose response is of greatest importance. But I often don't feel like I have a great deal of control over that. And I think a lot of work is being done going to benchmark doses and using pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic modeling, you know, to improve the you know, dose response paradigm. So I think we're making progress there. But, you know, when it comes down to a Superfund site, it's often just the exposure that creates the biggest, dollops, if you will, of uncertainty. I mean, something as basic as, you know, how much soil does a young child ingest? Because, you know, ultimately we make decisions on cleaning up, you know, contaminants in soil, and it's usually driven by just that parameter, which is extremely uncertain. So it's not very glamorous, but just some basic research into, you know, exposure science, I think, is probably what would go a long way. And then when Meredith was talking about the social aspects of that, we see that play out in, all right, well, if you have contaminated fish, say, all right, well, you know, because, again, you know, provide some estimates of what fish consumption is, but then if you have like a Native American community, they're eating a lot more fish, and so now you have to, you know, get into the social sciences of what their specific, fish ingestion, trends are. So I think the exposure side, you know, needs probably, well, I think it's working at a lot of bang for our buck, just spending more time there, even though it seems less science, if you will.
Yeah, good point. And I think that's critical. Tying together that theme you made earlier, Mark, about dealing with subpopulations like tribal areas that, again, might have different consumption levels, and you have to vary it with the specific site. I think, Claudia, is there an incoming comment that from the simulcast participants that might be good to raise?
Well, there is, but it probably kind of goes back to sort of where Mark's going as far as where interdisciplinary teams need to be for addressing particular questions, and this is actually a comment probably more related to one of the first questions having to do with that came from Mark Hahn at Woods Hole and Boston University, and it had the whole issue of dealing with mixtures, and of course that's another very complex issue. I think that does in fact cry for sort of an interdisciplinary sort of approach and bringing lots of groups together. But he just wanted to make the point that, with EPA highlighting that as an area, as far as precision making, there are still a lot of basic research questions in toxicology that can be addressed through something like the Superfund program. Some of the challenging questions that he mentions in toxicology involves interactions between the chemicals, whether of a similar class or of different classes, questions on how the chemicals of different potencies and efficacies interact at receptor sites, using things such as toxic equivalency factor approach, and also the basic research on the crosstalk between signaling pathways involved with mechanisms of toxicity. So although it's not direct to this, it is focused on something that really begs to have more of an interdisciplinary approach taken, both from the health side as well as the non-biomedical side, or the state and transport and interactions in different environmental mediums.
Thank you. Any reactions, comments, based on the comments coming in from our Woods Hole participants there?
Yes, this is Chuck Maurice in US EPA in Chicago.
Hello, Chuck.
Hi. I just would like to expand on the it's more than mixtures. Mixtures is important, very important. I don't want to downplay it at all. But I think we also need to think beyond chemicals and getting into more cumulative risk, where you're considering not only mixtures of chemicals but other physical, biological factors, sociological, economic factors that can play into the assessment of risks, which can make certain populations more vulnerable. Mark mentioned about the tribal situation with eating more fish. Well, that's an example of how, that's eating more fish is not going to be, in itself is not a stressor. However, it's a sociological situation in which their exposure is increased. So that has to be input into the risk calculation. So again, I don't want to downplay chemical mixtures. They're very important, and we need to move forward on that. But we also need to have a bigger context of the receptors, what they're seeing, what of the various sensitivities. Different species have different sensitivities, just by their life cycle. They can have different exposures when you get into the ecological receptors, but also just within human populations, you have a whole spectrum of different types of exposure scenarios that you can get into.
Excellent point there, Chuck. Appreciate that. I think that builds on that discussion earlier and captures cumulative risk and the economic and social factors that need to be looked at, and the uncertainties that the communities and the field folks are focusing on out there. Go ahead.
This is Ron again. Just to follow up on the tribal issue, and it opens up, a general comment about other groups that the SRP might want to consider working with or complementing. And I apologize if any of these are repeats, that you've already been down this track. I'm somewhat new to this, but just in listening to the conversation and the highlight on the tribal, we have a variety of research efforts that have gone on looking into unique exposure scenarios in tribal and other specific communities. We also have a tribal science council where we try to coordinate the science needs of the tribes, and some of it has involved hazardous waste sites, but there certainly would be an opportunity to engage the tribes. We're actually having the Tribal Science Council meeting in Washington tomorrow. We also have a tribal research grants program. So again, that might be opportunities to collaborate with RFAs that may go out through EPA's Office of Research and Development and the SRP. And there's kind of similar tracks that might be worth pursuing in a variety of other areas. I mean, OSWA, as far as I know, has a tribal coordinator, so that might be another piece to work with. And just, you know, talking about the outreach, EPA has a community outreach program to civic communities impacted by hazardous waste sites. I don't know if they've ever gotten to any of the research questions, but I think they do provide funding for the communities to develop work groups to focus on the issues the communities are facing and, you know, some of the health issues that could be supported by research and science needs discussions might also be worth pursuing. And lastly, just another example is, you know, we have a small business innovative research program also, and part of our solicitation this year was on, I think it was, haz waste remediation technologies. So it just seems like there's a lot of opportunities to coordinate across different programs and foster collaboration between our different efforts.
Good. Thank you, Ron. There are a lot of great thoughts here, so we're capturing this. Thank you so much. And so if there are any other comments here, we're about ready to move on to the next question, but was there another person who wanted to...
Yes. Yeah, this is David Fair again in Oregon, and we were just talking about the disciplines, other disciplines that might be included, or when I heard the comment about the mixtures and also looking at health in more in the broader context of, you know, social habits and those kind of things, I thought maybe a discipline I haven't heard mentioned is epidemiology, and I wondered if... I mean, in public health, we're always trying to answer the question, when we're involved with the Superfund, so it's always, our question is, will this make people sick? And sometimes good epidemiological research can, you know, at similar sites or other areas could be very helpful. So maybe just throwing out there that maybe epidemiology could be another discipline to reach out to or include more in this kind of research.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you.
This is Pat Cassano from GE. I have a question. We're on slide 17, correct?
Yes.
Okay, I have a fundamental question, I guess, which, and I'm not a scientist. I'm more of a policy person and a compliance person. But, you know, the question is worded in terms of, is the current framework the most effective approach? But it's not clear to me what the current framework is. It's not clear that any of the preceding slides describe the framework, and maybe they do, and it's just not labeled that way. But also, if you go to the Superfund Research Program website, you know, there's sort of a general description of what the Superfund Research Program is about, but it's a couple of paragraphs. I can't find anything that says, here's what our framework is. And you can find things like the list of grantees, but you can't find what the projects are that they're working on and how it fits together and what questions they're answering. So I guess my question is fundamentally, what do you mean by current framework in the question, and is it actually described somewhere?
Hi, Pat. This is Heather Henry from the program, and I appreciate that question. Certainly for those of you who are new to the program wouldn't immediately understand what we mean by that. When I was talking about, first of all, one type of framework are the three types of grants that we offer, and that is a multi-project program grant, which are large grants funded up to 3 years, or excuse me, up to 5 years, and include biomedical projects, two biomedical projects, as well as two non-biomedical projects. So that's kind of one type of framework that we utilize. In addition, we offer the R01, which is a smaller investigator. One investigator applies for a grant. So this is a much smaller team. It doesn't mean that the team would not be an interdisciplinary team, but it just means that the project itself is more focused. And then, of course, we have the all business innovative offerings. So that's kind of what we mean by framework is, you know, the size of the program, the size of the grant that we fund, the length of them, and, again, the use of biomedical and non-biomedical to achieve the interdisciplinary framework. This is currently what we use, but, of course, we're interested in hearing from those of you out there to see how we might, you know, better do this better, or, again, another part of the question was what are the challenges or barriers to interdisciplinary research.
And, Pat, we could use more time, maybe deal with you offline. If you go to the website, you can tab down to each university program to find the specific research projects they're working on, the updates for those, the publications they've gotten, the sites where they've been applied, all that is there. If you can't get to it, why don't you work with us offline and we can show you how you can take full advantage of all that information that is really fills up the website there.
Thank you.
You bet. Maybe we should move on then to slide 18. The training area, and again, just continuing on, segueing from the interdisciplinary aspects of the program, here we'd really be interested in looking at the approaches to training that you believe out there would be most appropriate for the Superfund research program. Again, I think the SRP really prides itself on trying to focus on training for future researchers with postdocs. We've said over 100 folks that are out there being supported by the program, looking at the various disciplines, trying to bring them into multidisciplinary teams, and the alumni from the program are working in academia, working in EPA, ATSDR, state agencies, local agencies along the line that way. But again, the interdisciplinary is often a difficult area to deal with, and I might ask Meredith to chat a little bit about this because it has been raised within the program that, again, just as from my old program, EPA tends to be in silos based on statute, Clean Water Act, Superfund, et cetera, you know, academia often is in silos based on the various scientific disciplines. And what SRP has been working at for years is to encourage that boundary interaction and training with the folks coming into the program. So, again, we'd just like to open it up. And, Meredith, would you like to just kick it off there with some of your thoughts on the interdisciplinary training?
Well, sure. First of all, the training at Columbia basically incorporates postdocs and graduate students from the Mailman School of Public Health in the areas of environmental health science and epidemiology and a few other of the other departments there, as well as students that work at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in the geological sciences in terms of geochemistry and hydrology, et cetera. And getting them together, I think, is just a very important part of the training so that they can start to understand the language that the others use from each side of the line there. And sometimes they switch over as well, which is interesting. They might think that they're going to be focusing on public health, and in the end they get very interested in the public health aspects of geology. So I find that very interesting. We have various workshops throughout the year and in the summers, training them on risk assessment and geospatial technologies and things of that sort. I think in some ways the students are in the forefront because they're very open to interdisciplinary approaches, and in turn the professors and the faculty start to hear the language and also have entered into collaborative agreements and collaborative projects. And it kind of works hand in hand, but that's kind of just a brief summary of what we do.
We also saw that Jake Gandolfi was on the phone line at some point, and I wondered if he'd like to chime in. He's from the Arizona, University of Arizona program. Jay, if you happen to still be on the line. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. He's simulcast.
So send us a note, Jay. Send us a note while you're sitting there. We appreciate getting your input there because I thought you were quite eloquent at the national meeting last month on the importance of interdisciplinary training. Again, maybe turn back to the people on the line, the field practitioners out there. And again, it sort of harkens back to Shelley, your point about the various disciplines you bring to the table when you're looking at Superfund sites. And Mark, I know that you're also, when you were working on World Trade Center, you know, you were looking at analytic methods, bringing in OSHA, bringing in APSDR, again, whatever analogies you have all out there as far as, you know, what cross-training would you like if you were going to be hiring SRP graduates in the future, whether in academe or other public health sectors?
Well, Larry, one thing we try to do is, and we have the luxury of at least, Columbia and our regional offices, being on the same island here and just, an A train away. So, we could, it's easier to collaborate, but the single best thing that anyone in academia could do is just spend some time working in the Superfund program. If there's some way that they could hook up with their regional office, whichever is closest to them, just so that, the students could spend a few weeks or even or through their summer program, just immersing themselves in risk assessment, that would be value beyond words. And they would get a real sense, because when I first came to the EPA, I was just entered into the doctorate program at Columbia, and I hadn't the slightest idea what kind of dissertation I wanted to do. I wasn't in the Superfund program, 2 months, and I had like a laundry list of risk assessment projects that I thought would be doable, because it's such an uncertain science. So that's what I would recommend.
Mark, would something like an internship or intern type of program associated with a training program, would that be of use? Is that where you're going?
Be very, extremely valuable to any academic that was engaged in Superfund research program.
This is, Ron, it's interesting because we're considering something somewhat similar for our extramural STAR research grants and fellowships to, obviously, you don't want to make it mandatory. It's rather offer them the opportunity if they have interest in the applied side of their research and there's a good match between their interest and something that's going on in a region. And we're looking, broader than Superfund, but that certainly could be a case. Would there be a way that we could arrange for them to go to one of the regions and even possibly an ORD lab to get the other side of it? But it would be interesting if SRP has interest in pursuing that also.
Well, and that is a good point to a initiating extent. The University of North Carolina's SRP program has worked with APSDR, for example, in a pilot effort that still needs a lot more going on, but working with them on public health application at brownfields and looking at models they were developing and things like that. There is coordination that's necessary, but I think that's a great idea, Mark, of future training programs, including some kind of affiliation with the EPA headquarters or regional offices that way in real world kind of interaction.
Yeah, and I think you gave also a good example of it, Larry, between UNC and RTP. There seems to be a lot of collaboration going on down there.
Yep, good. good point, Mark.
And again, this is a question that came in from Bill Hagel. This is Heather Henry speaking on behalf of one of the simulcast participants. This is a question to us, is what type of training does SRP currently do? So I think you've heard about a couple of examples. Meredith Golden walked you through them. We talked a little bit about UNC and some semi-internship program. We don't have a formal internship program. And I think really the best way to answer Bill's question is to say that we allow each program of the multi-project program grants, and we allow them to formulate their own training program. And so that might be a program that involves a lot of community outreach or research translation activities. It might be geared towards participation in technology transfer activities or understanding commercialization. We let them do what they want. In most cases, the training involves bringing together these graduate and postdoc students from, again, multiple disciplines, bringing them together and having them focus on issues that come up. So that tends to be the typical manifestation of these training courses. And anything else to add, Claudia or Bill?
No.
So hopefully that answers your question about what we're doing currently.
Good. Unfortunately, I probably need to keep us moving along here. And again, there'll be an opportunity at the close, and for people filling out the questionnaire, if you didn't get a chance to enter your ideas or you're going to send them in by email, we'll follow up with you that way. But if we could just move on to slide 19. And again, it's one of those critical issues that we appreciate your insights to the program or your experience in the field. And, you know, the first is a very basic question. Who should be SRP stakeholders? Ideally, you'd like to say everybody, but it just can't be that way in the real world. So again, from your experiences out there, whom you would suggest would be the most critical sectors, most critical focal groups that the SRP should be looking at? And more importantly, how can the SRP most effectively interact with them? You know, two-way communication is what we know is critical. You can't just be sending out information and hoping people are interacting with it, but you want to make sure that it is meeting clients' needs. So maybe you could just open that up again. Would like to hear from EPA, the state agencies, industry, if you would like to weigh in, or academics, just short views, perhaps, of stakeholders and how to best interact with them.
So, this is Claudia here at NIHS. We received a question earlier today that was submitted by one of our simulcast participants, Bob Weber from EJORD in Kansas City. And this might help sort of stimulate your thoughts in answering this. The question came in is, what methods of communication outreach have the SRP used to engage EPA regional offices? So over the years, we've done a number of different things. I'm going to start answering this, and others might want to chime in. A couple of things that we do. We have a monthly newsletter called Research Brief that goes out to over 5,000 subscribers, many of them at EPA offices in the regions, both university folks, company, folks in industry, international, and those research briefs basically take a finding that has come out of the program and puts it in terms of its potential application, significance, et cetera. In addition, we have tried over the years to have regional visits to EPA offices out in the regions, where a number of us from the SRP will come and meet with folks to just discuss the needs and issues that you're facing. We also have been invited to the National Association of Remedial Project Managers annual meeting, and we've held sessions there, both from program staff giving presentations as well as particular topics interested to NARPA, to the project managers, and we'll have investigators from the program give talks at that. We've been invited to the National Risk Assessors meetings and have posted sessions there. In addition, we also support a number of workshops and conferences, and what are appropriate as often as we can, bring in regional folks with that interest to be on our planning committees, be invited to the workshops, et cetera. I think probably the most recent was actually at the Superfund's annual meeting where we worked with Mike Gill for the, there was a particular session, satellite meeting, looking at a number of issues for the individual research projects as far as future directions in areas like bioavailability, sediments, et cetera. And we had input both from EPA folks as well as investigators working on topics of interest. So those are just a few different approaches that we've used, and we would really like to hear from anyone and everyone what other kinds of methods that we could use to more effectively interact both ways.
Hi, this is Rob Weber, and I'm with EPA's Office of Research and Development. And I think it was mentioned at least earlier on the call, each regional office in EPA has an ORD employee stationed there. They're known as Superfund and Technology Liaisons, and they wear a number of hats. They're also scientists that sit in the region, and they might be a good venue to contact to help get the word out in the regions also.
Thank you. That's very critical, and I know we haven't gotten to Kansas City lately, but really appreciate Ron Landy and other STLs who have showed up at meetings that we've had in other parts of the country. But you're right, you all are a critical group that we definitely see as a critical part of collaboration with EPA Office of Research Development and the program offices. Again, I think you all on the phone are critical stakeholders. As we said, whether it's EPA, state health departments, state environmental programs, working collaboratively with academics, the SRP researchers, other academic institutions, private sector firms, all these are critical groups that we see as stakeholders. And we'll be talking more later about public outreach and things like this. And Claudia just gave you an overview of the different ways we have of interacting. So we do need to move on, but again, offer an opportunity for folks to react to perhaps the various tools that Claudia was going over as far as what we do now to deal with our stakeholders. Just any reaction before we move on to the next question?
Go ahead.
Claudia, this is Meredith Golden, and actually I was hoping that Ron Landy might mention he and Jane Michaud had suggested some ideas on how we might interact with EPA and APSDR. And I didn't know if Ron's there, if he wants to bring that up, but he was suggesting a working group that would review the different progress reports from all of the SRP grantees and see what might be promising, and then from going from there, providing the right networking and contacts to follow through to kind of make that link. So if Ron wants to talk more about that now, that would be fine with me. If we don't have time, we can pursue it later.
If you want me to mention that, I can, or we can wait till the end and see if we have time. I mean, it relates to some of the other things you've discussed, but I know you're on a quick time frame, so you let me know, if you want me to mention it, or wait till the end.
That sounds like a great creative idea that we'll put down here, especially since you have it moving out there. And I think we've got one or two comments coming in, Claudia, that you would like to raise here.
Right. So we have a couple of comments from our simulcast listeners. One's from Kathleen Graham at EPA in Denver. In terms of interactions with stakeholders, she stated that the emailed research briefs are a useful method of receiving research outcome information. Workshops are great, but given limited travel funds for many stakeholders, that we should consider more efforts to push info out to stakeholders via emails, conference calls, and other virtual methods.
The second comment we got from Bill Hagel at ORD in Philadelphia. He wrote that stakeholders equal practitioners in the field, especially EPA regional offices, RPMs, and OSCs, states and other federal agencies such as APSCR, active in implementing the Superfund program.
Great. Thank you. Well, we should probably move on slide 20, and that's the area of research translation that we noted earlier. And basically what we're asking for your input on are what are the best ways for the SRP to achieve its goal of research translation, roughly defined as making research more accessible by end users. And again, just to trigger the conversation here, the interaction with you all is, how do you get your latest research results now and useful science information? And are there more ways we should be, SRP should be using to reach out to get the research communicated and being applied? Again, Claudia had mentioned the variety of ways that are done now, from the monthly research briefs that go out to, as Maureen Avakian proudly says, over 5,000 people each month that go out there. Again, the conferences, either jointly with EPA, the regional visits, that are explored there, the information brought out on the website, the collaboration by the individual Superfund research programs around the country with states and regional offices. Again, here, just if folks believe that there are particular techniques that are used by others that we haven't touched upon yet that we should be employing in the future.
Larry, this is Ron. Over the past, couple of months while I've been involved with this, I've noticed just, the great efforts by the STLs and some of your grantees are really looking for ways to apply the research. I mean, they really want to see the value and get it out of the lab and get it beyond publication. And one thing we talked briefly about at the New York City meeting is, we have a similar situation in ORD. We have, 2,500 people involved in all different types of research, but how do we get it delivered? How do we get it over the finish line so it's actually used to benefit the regions, state, local governments that could use the science? And I mentioned this to Bill and Meredith that, we have a program called Regional Applied Research Effort, where we set aside a very small amount of our budget, but that money is meant really to work with the client and say, there's this great research, we think it's really valuable, how can we get it over the finish line so you can use it? And that might be something, for SRP to consider, so their grantees, really promising research, just need that little bit extra amount of resources to get that model, that remediation technique, whatever, tested and ready for use by RPM or, someone in a similar position. And that program has been very successful, and it also allows us to document the ultimate benefit of the research to these clients. And we require the client to be, even though it's led by the researcher, the client has to be intimately involved and make sure that the product that they requested is going to come out of that research and that they're willing to demonstrate and report back on the benefit that they've perceived from it. So just another thought to throw out of considering some type of small Superfund research program, applied research effort to capitalize and further what I think are already a lot of attempts, but this would push it even further.
Good point, Ron. Thank you. And again, as you mentioned, there's a lot of collaboration ongoing between SRP and STOLs, STLs, as well as the broader research program there. So I appreciate your providing that creative insight.
Larry, this is Mark. Just, you know, someone had already mentioned that they gave presentations at the annual Superfund Risk Assessors meeting. So, I mean, that is a great way to, get to your targeted audience. But that's only annual. But we also hold, you probably well know, a monthly, risk assessment teleconference for Superfund. In fact, we're having one in 2 days. So that would be another mechanism for getting the word out.
That's a good point, Mark. We should probably work with you and your colleagues and Jane Michaud and headquarters to get, semi-periodically, maybe a couple times a year, and tee up, the particularly very late-breaking kinds of research results that would be, of high interest and applicability to you all. Good point.
This is Chuck Maurice, EPA ORD in Chicago.
Yeah, Chuck.
And I along the same lines, I guess, just taking it farther, you might consider having a webinar series, with a round robin going through the different research projects that are funded. And, those of us in the STLs, as well as those in the risk assessment networks and within EPA and also in the states, we would be able to possibly bridge that gap also of translating the research into real applied situations in those cases where maybe a webinar is given on a particular topic and a particular researcher for that particular webinar would be at a point in time where, well, we're ready to test this out in the field. And it would then have a whole network available of potential Superfund sites that it could be tested at.
Great idea. Great idea. That's something we definitely would like to follow up on.
And that,
because you say
it would be that two-way street that you referred to before, because the states and EPA and industry, anyone who would tune into the webinars would be benefiting by getting the cutting edge information that's coming out, but also the researchers themselves would be getting the benefit of then be getting input from real life situations, or if their research isn't at a certain particular critical point, possibly getting them in the door to applying it at a real site to see if, does concept meet reality.
Exactly. That's a great thought that I know there's strong interest on researchers, as you say, to match up their research with programmatic needs out there. And just the question, as you say, is getting the right venues to match up the late-breaking research that has already been, pilot tested and is ready for a broader application in the field. So good thoughts. I guess we should move on. We're coming to closure here on our last question area on slide 21, and it's dealing with that broad area of community outreach. The question of what are the appropriate goals for community outreach for the Superfund Research Program. I think we all know that can be a difficult area to define and to implement. It's a key part of the Superfund Program. And we also know that the new assistant administrator in EPA for Solid Waste Emergency Response, Maddie Stanislaus, is focusing on the reaching out through community engagement, even more aggressive interaction with communities out there. So I guess that's just the bottom line for you all who've been doing a lot of community outreach, and the SRP programs have been also some tribal, some local communities, again, a wide variety of outreach tools. What, from your experiences, you would think would be, the most appropriate short and long-term goals for SRP to, you know, most effectively engage in outreach.
Well, Larry, this is Mark. Again, if you had some of the academics come in and do some sort of a rotation through the office, the first thing I would do would be, you know, send them out when, you know, we go out with our, you know, our proposed remedial action plan out into the, you know, the public meeting that is, you know, a statutory requirement. And they would get an earful, as we usually do at those meetings. But, you know, and then you'd see it all, you know, how the local politicians angle and how, you know, the community activists get into the mix and so on and so forth. There's no substituting for you know, sitting through one of those. But that's what, you know, that would be, I think, very helpful to people, you know, that are on the academic end of these research programs and how you do community outreach.
I'm also wondering if that would be helpful to EPA, Mark, in the sense that it's showing EPA's openness, bringing in, you know, university researchers to assist and participate in, you know, this difficult problem assessment and responding to community concerns.
I think, Larry, I think it would be, and as you know, when we had that research translation up at Lamont Doherty, you know, I was commenting on that, you know, academics tend to have a very high level of, you know, trust and credibility within communities. So while we often, you know, get looked at with a raised eyebrow, you know, when college professors and you know, other, you know, academians, you know, comment, they tend to be, listened to more intently by the community. So that would certainly be, you know, mutually beneficial, I think.
You're good. Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Hey, this is Pam Schwingel from Social and Scientific Systems, the private research firm in RTP. We work with NIEHS. And it seems that in this community outreach effort that academicians would have a role for certain and have credibility. EPA has the raised eyebrow, but there's a lot of work, and my sense is that there's going to be a lot more work in terms of this, I think, communities, the consciousness about communities, from communities about environmental concerns is increasing. And I'm just wondering about the role of the private research firm in terms of actually being a support or partner to both universities and academicians to actually do some of the work. because I think that there's a lot of work in communities to be done. And so, of course, that would mean funding, but I think that there's, we have teams of, for example, you know, in the private research firms, there's teams of epidemiologists and social scientists who could also bridge some of those gaps.
Okay. Good. Good. Thank you. And you're just down the street from us.
Yes. Right.
Okay. Any other, comments or suggestions people would have before we turn this over to Bill to bring us to a close here?
This is Meredith Golden again. Sorry for the background noise, but I just wanted to mention that with Research Translation and Outreach annual meeting, we did have Suzanne Wells there, the Director of Community Involvement Program and Initiatives at EPA, and she has a lot going on, so I would heartily recommend that we work closely with EPA's ongoing, and APSCR as well, their ongoing community involvement programs, and work with them on specific sites.
Good. Thank you, Meredith. Any other comments that folks would like to add here? At this point, thank you. Thank you. This has been very helpful. Appreciate the total enthusiasm, the diverse comments that we've been getting here on these variety of questions. And we have fully used our time today. And again, I think we got what we were hoping for, these insightful comments, your experiences, what you would well, from your experience, what you would suggest, what you need, where you'd like the program going in future, collaboration efforts that we should build on, continue on, and appreciate those insights. And with that, we'd like to wrap up the question period here and turn it back over to Bill Sook.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. First of all, I want to thank everybody for participating, whether you were a vocal participant or whether you were just there listening and taking it all in. Would appreciate any thoughts and comments that you could provide to us at a later date. The slide number 22 that you see up there has the strategic planning questionnaire. It has our website /strategic plan. And other information. This site, this site is not up yet. It will be up for the next couple of days, so write your questions down and then provide them. Again, I want to thank you, and your input and your thoughts are very important. And besides being helpful, they're very important to ensure that the program continues to mature and evolve and address many of the complex public health issues that are of concern in exposure to hazardous substances emanating from sites. Again, thank you, and I would continue to tap into our website on a regular basis to provide us with input and thoughts and advice, but also just for general information purposes as well. Again, have a good afternoon. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.